high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments on the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have an exciting hour coming your way. Randy Fine, the congressman who replaced Mike Waltz over in Florida, will be with us, 6th District in Florida. Jillian Turner filling in for Martha all week. You see at the State Department during the week and filling in all around the D.C. Bureau, who, I, according to reports, did not know how to get to the 15th floor and where to go. Right, Jillian?
I didn't even know that I was going to the 15th
you,
floor.
You just came in and said, I'm looking for radio.
It was sheer luck that I got off on the 15th floor just now.
Lucky for me. Let's go to the big three.
Number three.
This is of a piece with the president seeming to imagine that this man, Putin, with whom he says he has a great relationship, is a man of peace. The evidence of that, it seems to me, particularly at this point, is extremely thin.
That is the great Brit Hume. They can win, Mr. President. Ukraine's daring double attacks on bridges, trains, and military bases shows you Russia might maybe thugs, but as military, they are not studs.
Number two.
This is really something what's happened. We've created over 500,000 new jobs in a short period of time, secured nearly $15 trillion, new dollars, new investments that are going into our country.
And that's what the president's got to do, explain the one big beautiful bill. It gets roasted by Musk and propelled forward by Thune, Johnson, and Trump. We look at the explosive term defining this explosive piece of legislation that will be defining the president's term.
Number one.
I really have thought long and hard about this, is to follow my own compass. I think we need to stop thinking in boxes and think outside of our boxes and not be so partisan.
What? KJP, yes, the former press secretary for Joe Biden, in a baffling announcement, worst press secretary in American history, leaves her party and is about to blow up perhaps Biden, her co-workers, her party. I don't know. Jillian, you are in Washington. Great to see you, by the way.
You too.
You're in Washington every single day. Are you stunned between the Tapper book, where he suddenly realizes that Joe Biden might not have an A game, to this? Is this the bigger surprise?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about that. I will say, look, everybody's got to make a buck, right? Why are you hating on them? I'm just kidding. I forget, people can't see my face.
Yeah, but you're being sarcastic, but you're just saying, for the longest time, she told everybody that Joe Biden has been great, and now she says, and the Independent, the story of the broken White House.
Broken White House. But
what?
At the same time, Brian, so she wants to now separate herself from everything that happened the last 4 years, but she also wants to do it without criticizing the president or too many of her former colleagues. And it's like, this is one of the most public figures, political figures in America, right? This was the face of the White House for 4 years, or not the entire, most of the 4 years. If you're going to then break with the administration that you represented, you got to have a real good explanation. You can't wake up and say, well, now I'm going independent. What does that mean?
So I'll give you an example. If Joe Manchin said, I'm going independent, I go, all right. If you have John Fetterman says, I'm going independent, I go, well, kind of makes sense. There's nothing middle of the road for her, because I watched her on MSNBC, and you probably did too. You probably could see some cuts of her. She's like the squat. I mean, she's way to the left. So to be independent now means that you're going somewhere or running from something to find a new home. Do you see some of the anonymous quotes about what kind of job she did and how she was? People did not respect her inside the White House, let alone the press corps.
There was massive consensus, right, in Washington that she was not only was she not great in her role, but she was nowhere near as good as Jen Psaki had been. And there was that unfortunate, you get compared
she was
to
really
your
good.
Predecessor.
Jen Psaki was excellent.
She was, right. The thing is, she never explained her own. We know about Jen Psaki, right? And it's not just because she has her own show on MS now. We know a little bit about her story and her family. Corrine never once not even in those like Vogue interviews that she did or Vanity Fair or whatever it was, talk about how she sees the world and how she wants things to be. And
exactly.
So it's like, okay, she's going independent, but it's like, I guess that makes as much sense as anything else about her because we have no idea.
Exactly. I mean, what she was.
We don't know what she stands for.
Remember she told us her first day what made her special? Black lesbian first. All right. That's what you wanted to stand out. That old identity politics, which she's welcoming. Mark Halperin offered some analysis today. Cut five.
There's still a lot we don't know. And so I hope she adds that historical record. Amazingly, the officials who are identified in the Tapper Thompson book as being involved with the attempt to cover up. I don't call it a cover up because there was nothing to cover up. It was all on C-SPAN and Fox News. Those officials haven't reacted. Now, I haven't seen them quoted anywhere explaining their position. Now, as you know, some Republicans in Congress would like them to come up and testify. And if that happens, maybe we'll get more of the truth. But I'm all for her adding to the historical record. But if she doesn't acknowledge what everybody in America saw in real time about Joe Biden's decline, I think it's going to be difficult for her to argue that this book's got credibility.
That's just it. I don't get what her position is. If she's going to be like Jill Biden and say her husband's fine, all right, but nobody thinks that. And Anita Dunn tried to get rid of her. Jeff Zients tried to get her another job. Other people thought she did a terrible job defending President Biden, had to look at her binder because she didn't know the issues. You know this because you had a job in the State Department. You know what people's like when they're staffers who get the issue even better than the principal. She was the opposite. I think Jen Psaki could have set policy.
There was even, yes, exactly. She could have been and probably was, like Dana was to President Bush, a policy advisor, right? I mean, you start trusting your press secretary's judgment so much.
Ari Fleischer, too,
and Ari, of course, yeah. She did not follow that model. Because as we are now learning from reporting that came out yesterday, more details today, she was very consumed by her own sort of PR profile while she was doing the White House job. Apparently, she got in trouble with colleagues for including her like PR rep that she hired, somebody in New York, including them on emails that she was sending from her official government email with other White House staff talking about White House business. I mean, she was working hard to try and get her own name out there at the same time she was doing this. So actually, in that perspective, the book's not surprising. Also, I think it was Jesse yesterday made an amazing point, which is like, okay, you don't write a book this long in how many months is it now since the administration?
Yeah,
February, March.
10 weeks.
You don't write a like 300 something page book in that amount of time. So she was working on the book while she was still working at the White House.
Although Tapper claims that he started the book in November, but who knows?
Well, I guess if you have a ghostwriter, but she didn't decide in the last 3 months that she was going to go independent and write and get a publishing deal for an entire book.
Jillian Turner with us. Jillian, what is the problem with John Kirby? And evidently, they did not get along. This is an admiral, the new military. You had a hostage situation, the Afghanistan situation, the Hamas horrific attack. You needed a military expert there. What was the problem?
Well, so the story goes that everybody knew that, what you just said. Everybody recognized, you know, we need a face in here who, you know, put it this, first of all, the White House wanted to replace Jen Psaki only with a woman. So they picked Corrine for the job, understanding that she was going to work in tandem with Kirby, right? Like whenever there was a big story or whenever there was anything relating to national security, foreign policy, the military, he was going to step in. And this was agreed to ahead of time. But then as this played out, Corrine did not want that. She did not want to share the podium with him. And so she made a concerted effort within the White House with staff to kind of push him out whenever possible. And, you know, those briefings suffered when he needed to be there and he wasn't there.
All right, let's talk about another area. First off, How long were you in the State Department? Is that where you were?
I was a staffer at the White House in the National Security Council 4 years. The last 2 years of the Bush administration, the first two of Obama, because I was not a political appointee. So you
right.
keep going. I worked in the State Department only before my current job where I'm covering it as an intern for 6 months, full time. It was like my junior year of college. I took off a whole semester to go work there full time.
Who's your supervisor?
And they were like,
anybody I would know?
A guy named, well, this is going to date me, but it was at the end of Colin Powell's tenure as Secretary of State. No joke. The person who I reported to is a diplomat named Mike Kozak, who's been around a long time. He might even still be at State now. He's like a career ambassador. He's been to like 10 different countries. So I had a foot in the door at State before I started covering it, meaning like I know how things work and I know how, you know, how everything goes down, how the sausage is made.
So when you see what's going on with Ukraine right now and you know the State Department's got to do some work, but you have a guy running the State Department who's also a national security advisor. At the same time, you got NATO summits going on. You have trade talks happening. Let alone the border issue. This is pretty amazing what's on Rubio's plate, right?
It is super interesting. I'm borderline obsessed with the fact that he is now in these two roles, and he's the first person in forever to do this. I asked Tammy Bruce, this was on the record, like maybe 2-3 weeks ago, because I've only been back from maternity leave like 3 weeks now. So sometime in the last 3 weeks.
Second child.
I asked Tammy, like, how does he feel about this? Because it's been unclear, right? Like, if he was gung-ho for this or if he was kind of dragged into it. And she said, honestly, Jillian, he's joyous. Those were her words, joyous at doing both jobs. He loves it.
He's also an archivist, too. They say that.
And he's the archivist. And, Brian, he just, you know, in case anybody's, you know, keeping tabs on him, he's over at the White House. Every day he comes over to State to like do what he needs to do, greet, you know, foreign dignitaries when they arrive, have meetings. But he's at the White House. He is very focused on the president,
which is interesting because they say when Kissinger did both jobs, he was never at the White House.
Right. Exactly.
It was the opposite.
Yep.
So, you know, I thought Mike Waltz did a great job. I'm a big fan. I think he's going to be an impact player, UN ambassador. And is so knowledgeable, knows the military, knows diplomacy, worked for Cheney. Did his own housework, Green Beret.
I think it's the White House's loss that he's not there.
I still don't get it anymore. What do you think the story is there?
Well, so some people have been saying all along, like, this is not going to work because, I mean, we all know Mike Waltz from our air because as a member of Congress, you know, he came and talked
to us
all the time. He's a foreign policy hawk on Russia. On Putin in particular, my point being
on
Ukraine and Russia, he knows that Putin's a bad guy. He knows what side the United States is on. He doesn't exactly align with the MAGA folks on all the foreign policy issues.
He does Rubio, though.
It was a little which is one of the reasons I'm so obsessed with Rubio's role in this administration. Is like, how is he making all of this happen? The president loves him.
Yep. Listen, we're gonna take a time out, have some more quality time with Jillian Turner. She's gonna be hosting Martha's show today, right?
I am. 3 p.m.
At 3 p.m. Eastern time. Don't move. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. If you want something fun and easy to search for homes and apartments, then you should be using the Redfin app. Whether I'm searching for my next place, if I want to buy, if I want to rent, or if I just want to scroll through and see some dream homes, like, for example, something on the beach or at least a walk to the beach, a big house, second, maybe a third floor, I use the Redfin app. Redfin makes it fun to search all the homes for sale and apartments for rent in your neighborhood. You can filter for price, for beds, for baths, square footage, and so much more. So if you find a place you love, Redfin makes it easy to go see it in person. Just schedule a tour right from the app. Plus, if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents know how to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they close twice as many deals as other agents. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards your next home. So whether you're looking to buy, you're looking to rent, you're looking to sell, Redfin's got you covered. Download the Redfin app to get started.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we got a few more minutes with Jillian. Jillian, have you looked at the format today? I know you do a Martha show with three. Do you have a rough idea what you guys are doing today?
I legit have no idea, Brian, and I would have prepared had I known you were going to ask me that question because I'm sure it's an amazing lineup of guests.
Right.
Trina's filling in this week. She's doing a fantastic job. We've gotten all kinds of booking, so going to have to put that on ice, but it is going to be really great.
So here's what I know for sure.
That was the worst tease in the history.
No, but you left a lot of questions that makes me want to tune
radio in. And television.
It wasn't the best, but you left a lot of lot of intrigue out there. But here's what I know you're going to be running with. The most interesting thing in afternoon television is the Oval Office meetings with other world leaders.
Yeah.
So you got the Chancellor of Germany, who seems to be anti-Israel these days, and very pro-Ukraine, looking to develop long-range missiles to go right into Russia, and commits to 5% defense spending. What do you think Trump's going to do today? Because, you know, he's got the German heritage.
And he, yes, and he, I don't know how to say it, but he likes MERS.
He seems to.
He likes the leader, which, as you know, like, goes a really long way with him. So I don't think we're going to see, like, a Cyril Ramaphosa or Vladimir Zelensky style showdown. I could easily be dead wrong, but I wouldn't predict that.
Mm-hmm.
He's also trying. I mean, he wants all the reporting the last couple of weeks has been Germany is turning on Israel. Right. We had the foreign minister here 2 weeks ago. He met with Rubio at the end of May. I interviewed him right after he met with Rubio. And I said, like, what's the deal? Did you guys get into this? Did he, you know, kind of like take you to task over the fact that you guys are publicly very much pivoting away? I mean, you're threatening to withhold weapon shipments.
Mm-hmm.
You're criticizing Israel's humanitarian conduct. And he said, no, we're still 100% behind Israel. And I said, well, but you're not, you know, if you watch what Germany is doing and saying, you are very much not at all behind Israel any longer. And it's been this slow pivot that suddenly ramped up very recently. Like, what is the IDF, what is Netanyahu doing that is, you know, irritating you in this way? He wouldn't budge. He's not going to say, you know, he's not going to say, we've made a strategic decision to not back the Israelis anymore. But everybody knows that's what they're doing.
But, Jillian, you know, we only had a minute left, but you know that the Israelis are not going to sit on the sideline if these talks continue to linger with Iran. This is there. Even though President Trump said don't, they said Reagan said the same thing. Bush said the same thing. He bombed Syria and he bombed Iraq.
That's
because
right.
Because they had nuclear weapons.
That's right.
So they're going to take action.
And Netanyahu, I mean, exactly. And Netanyahu, I think, cares less and less about what the U.S. thinks. Not necessarily Trump,
certainly,
but like
Biden.
The U.S., yeah. You know, in right. general.
Because they got to worry about themselves. And also, they this got them in a place where their nuclear arsenal is vulnerable. It's not going to be the case for much longer.
And they have also been dragged through the mud, right? In terms of the U.S. can't, I mean, the U.S. spends all its time fighting about what to do.
Jillian Turner, thanks so much. We'll see you at 3 o'clock today with a great, intriguing show.
Thanks for having me, Brian. It's going to be the best.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. I don't know if you knew this, but anyone can get the same premium wireless for $15 a month plan that I've been enjoying. It's not just for celebrities. So do like I did and have one of your assistant's assistants switch you to Mint Mobile today. I'm told it's super easy to do at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I think we need to ask, you know, where did this guy come from and where was he inspired? People don't fall from the sky just hating Jews, shooting Jews, okay? He clearly is listening to the very loud and visible protests at places like Columbia. He clearly is listening to very loud and visible members of Congress, certain members of Congress. And we ask, why are they inspiring him and whether they plan to continue inspiring people like him?
So that was Jonathan Epstein. He's the Israeli ambassador shooting witness, commenting as a former Columbia University student, also commenting on the flame-throwing terrorist that acted in Boulder, Colorado. Joining us now is Congressman Randy Fine, Jewish from an Ivy League with an Ivy League background, now congressman from Florida. Congressman, he's 100% right, isn't he?
He absolutely is. Look, they've talked about globalizing the Intifada and resistance by any means necessary. This is what it looks like. This guy was taking his orders from above, whether it was directly or from being inspired by what he's hearing from our universities and from around the world, driven by false information that is given about Israel. This is what ends up happening.
So when you see what happened in Boulder, Colorado, and you see the president of the United States say, well, they had to toss out their family, too. They've also overstayed their visa and a court pushing back. What's your reaction?
Well, I think it's time for us to start taking a look at impeachments. Look, there's separation of powers and there's balance of power in the country. And we've got a judiciary that's out of control. And I think we need to step in and do something about it.
I love the fact that this guy said he's evidently said, I wanted for my last one to graduate, 18-year-old to graduate before I did this. It means it was thought out. Meaning also that you're going to tell me either they should have reported their dad or they agree with their dad.
And I am certain that when you watch, find videos of the family, I guarantee you'll see them at Free Palestine and all of these other violent rallies as well. Look, these people shouldn't be in the country. They should be gone. And frankly, we should be deporting everybody. The fact of the matter is everyone in this country illegally committed an original sin to get here. Everything they've done since is fruit of the poison tree, except maybe for the kids who were human trafficked here by their parents. But it's time to round them up and send them home. And we should certainly start with the people who hate America.
I want to get to the big, beautiful bill, but I do want to get your perspective. Where did you go to your undergrad?
I went to Harvard twice. I got my business degree there, too. It's the only institution I ever went to.
So Harvard has responded after President Trump signed a proclamation to suspend their visas for new Harvard international students, saying the United States under visas, most international students who used to study in universities or participate in academic exchange programs in the country, it directs the Secretary of State to consider revoking those visas. Harvard said this is yet another illegal retaliatory step taken by the administration in violation of Harvard's First Amendment. Where do you stand?
Well, what I'd like to see the administration do is more than Harvard. I mean, Harvard is fun to pick on because they're the best university in the world, but the problem extends far beyond Harvard. And I think there's another way to look at this problem. Look, the federal government keeps all of these universities alive. The notion that they're private really is false. Hillsdale College is private. Everybody else is dependent on federal money. Harvard doesn't take that many students into its program. And are we okay with our federal dollars keeping these institutions alive to educate foreigners? I mean, Americans should be going to these schools. In Florida, we require 90% of the students at our universities to be from Florida. Why? Because Florida taxpayers are who is paying for them. I think beyond the terrorism aspect, if American tax dollars are going to keep these universities open, they should be educating Americans.
Are you for a threshold? The president says, why is it 27 to 32% of Harvard students international? Why isn't, he goes, 15 sounds better for me. Is it wrong to do that?
I don't know what the actual number should be, but I think the fact of the matter is if you are dependent on federal tax dollars to stay around, you should be educating Americans. Now, look, I understand that we want actually viewpoint diversity. We want the best and the brightest to come here. But I think a big problem in our universities today is they are dependent on money from countries that hate us, like Qatar and China. And I think that infects how the universities are run. And I think that is a big problem. There are too many foreign students at these universities.
How about this? We just need to know what's in their background. I'm watching these kids' anti-Semitic rage go on. I'm seeing the faculty in support. Remember the encampments 2 years ago or last year? And then we see them in support. And then even though Harvard's getting all this scrutiny, they still had an anti-Semitic rally harassing Jewish kids from getting to their finals. So that, to me, is totally out of control. We have to find a way to at least Google these people's social pages.
But, Brian, it's more than that. I think even if you look at Columbia, the research that I've done shows it's not the real departments doing it. The physics professors are not out doing these rallies. It's these fake degrees that have cropped up in the last 30 years in gender studies. All of these fake humanities that have been generated where really the only thing you can do with your degree is work at Starbucks or be a professional protester. It's actually types of faculties. It's not the hard sciences that's doing these kinds of things. Maybe there are some, but it is these fake liberal woke institutions with professors who really don't know anything. It's like DEI. This isn't real. This is all fake academia. And that's what we need to return to, is actually teaching things. Look, when I went to Harvard, they were liberal. But in 6 years there, as an undergraduate and a graduate student, I never once felt unsafe because I was Jewish. And it breaks my heart that my son, who's 17 and for his whole life thought about going to Harvard, I don't even know that he should go to college based on what's going on out there today.
So I want to talk to you about the big, beautiful bill and Elon Musk pushed back to pass it. You're a fiscally responsible guy. You're a conservative. So he came out and said this basically will explode the deficit and destroy the country. What's your reaction?
Well, here's what I say. I think I understand Elon's concern. He's a brilliant man who's done an incredible amount for this country. And we are on a path to destroy America. Rome is burning. The problem is this. You can't solve the problem. If it was one big, beautiful bill and then we're done, then I would agree with him. But this is only the first step to solve the problem. And the problem we have is calling the continuation of tax rates a tax cut is a lie. The only people who are going to be getting tax cuts are people who are now not going to have to pay taxes on Social Security or now aren't going to have to pay taxes on tips or overtime. When the Democrats talk about millionaires and billionaires, they're not getting a tax cut. They're just going to keep paying what they have been paying, as are lots of other people. But there is $1.5 trillion in cuts. The problem is $1.5 trillion is not enough. Now, that doesn't mean it's not enough for this bill. It's just not enough in general. So what we need to do is say this isn't the end-all, be-all. Elon is right. This is not sustainable. We need to get this done, and we need to keep going. Because I'll tell you this, if we don't show the American people that we can govern, we will end up negotiating with Democrats, not Republicans. And that's a problem I don't want to see happen.
Here's what Rand Paul said. By the way, on the other side of this is Senator Josh Hawley and Susan Collins, who say, don't touch Medicaid. And other people say, how dare you not touch Medicaid? And this is the same party we're talking, Cut 13.
I do recall voting no on two of his impeachments, and I think he was okay with those no's.
Yes.
I do recall voting yes on his cabinet. I do recall guiding through Kristi Noem through my committee to be appointed in very quick fashion. So I think I've been quite supportive of the president. But I think in some ways we're talking past each other. So, for example, I support the tax cuts. I don't think the CBO is right. I think and agree with Art Laffer that you can reduce rates and get more revenue. Mm-hmm. I think that's what happened in 2017. I think the tax cuts have largely paid for themselves. I think renewing tax cuts that already exist, it's ridiculous to say that somehow that is going to cause a new deficit when they're just simply keeping the same policy.
But he does not want to spend more money on the border or defense. I'm for reforming Pentagon, but there's no way we don't have to bulk up the Pentagon.
Yeah, no, look, we need to do these things. And here's what I would say. If Rand Paul has more ideas on how to cut spending, I'm all in. Because the fact of the matter is we don't have a choice. but we may not be able to do it all in this bill. We should be working day in and day out to cut every single dollar. Because when people come in my office and they ask me for more money, I look at them and they say, why do you want to destroy America? Now, they look at me like I'm an alien. They say, why do you say that? I said, because you're asking us to borrow even more money that we don't have from our kids and grandkids. That has to stop. So we need to stop focusing on solving every problem in this bill. This bill's a good start. We have to focus on solving the problem, no matter how many bills it takes.
Very interesting. Fascinating to see what goes on here, because you got the Democratic Party tearing each other's eyes out. We have the former press secretary, and we have the president of the United States having now these liberal media writers of realizing he was asleep at the switch. And then for the Republicans, you have Elon Musk and conservatives and moderates going at each other. What is your take as somebody who just got to Washington?
My take is that Washington is broken because we do not govern as a team. My biggest disappointment, honestly, in being in Congress is everyone seems to be out for themselves. And I think Republicans need to be more worried about the judgment of their children than they are, frankly, the judgment of the voters. My kids will forgive me if I lose an election. They will not forgive me if I don't help save America. And if we don't stop our out-of-control spending, that's what will happen. I think people need to start to look at their kids' eyes when they make these votes. If they do that, we'll do the right thing. But there's too much fighting around stupid political things, and people need to keep their eye on the ball. Every empire in history, most of them have collapsed under the weight of debt. That will happen to us if we don't do something about it. But where I disagree with Elon or Rand Paul is that we have to solve it all in this bill. We should be working on the next bill and the next bill and the next bill to do this. It is going to take us a while to solve this problem.
Gotcha. He is making an impact already. Congressman Randy Fine, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate having me.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I'll squeeze in some calls, get your take. I want to also talk about what's happening in Ukraine. This is also dividing the Republican Party. You got people saying Mark Levin is a warmonger for back in Ukraine and saying that Israel should be able to strike Iran and giving up on Iran talks. I'm giving up on Iran talks, too, as I have for the last 30, 40 years. And I do think Israel's got to act soon. And I hope with our support. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Let's welcome Everett. They call him Duraflame because his books end up in the fireplace.
That is
Fox Red's co-host and host of One Nation, Brian Kilmeade. Brian,
yes.
You're a man's man. You're tough. You're virile. You're good looking. How could the Dems could have connected with you? See, with that, I complimented.
Very good.
I'm trying a new strategy.
We're waiting.
I'm sorry. I thought this was Gutfeld. I mean, are you kidding me? I've never had...
Brian, murders are down.
Yes.
Fentanyl seizures are down.
Yes.
Yet you are still here.
I know. That's so terrible.
What? Two out of three. Brian, it is... I mean, you are like the expert here. You've been doing cocaine for decades. And yet you're able to hold down a Fox and Friends gig. Maybe that's how you hold it down. You don't never go to sleep. You're just cranking lines in the green room, doing it off the toilet seats.
Was there a question? This is my third nose. So
that was Greg Gutfeld trying to throw people off yesterday and trying to be nice. It doesn't work for him. Am I right?
It was funny. I mean, he gave it that curveball. He was nice to you. And then the rest of his tosses to you were not so nice.
Right. Absolutely. Evidently, they met for like 2 hours and they nixed a lot of anti-Kilmeade jokes, which I found a little strange and somewhat
heartening. Why can't we ever get the nixed jokes? So who told you this? Was it one of the Joes?
No.
Oh.
It was somebody else.
Okay.
But what was I going to say? 37 appearances on Gutfeld. Isn't that pretty good?
They have these tallies. Is that like
that's
what they
Fox
you up
and
with?
Friends came up with?
Nice.
They Googled it. They say 37 appearances.
Not bad.
I mean, that's almost like Tyrus level.
Almost. No. But I think we should do a segment then. Every time you're on Gutfeld, the next day we have one of the writers come on
and talk about
the jokes that didn't make it.
Right. The ones that didn't make it. Evidently, they have a ton of jokes. They sit there for like 3 hours in that glass room. But it's by far, I mean, this morning, so I taped The Tonight Show. I'm telling you, Jimmy Fallon's the most likable guy, right? I've only met him cursory one time. But this is like, these are not even humorous. They're almost like a giggle. Like, I mean, they're just weird. It's not a real monologue anymore. It's like as if they're not trying. And then when they go to do the interviews, you have no idea where they're going with it.
Well, that was always true. But they're so afraid of touching any, like, quote-unquote third rails in the monologues. They just, they're not funny anymore.
So, you know, it's I watch SNL, and Dawn gets mad at me because she says, why do you watch this show? It's terrible. Because so it's newsworthy. Did you see Dave Chappelle came out? And after the pandemic, he hosted the show, and he got a lot of blowback because they didn't, like, they tried to cancel him, and he's just too popular. Here's what he said, and he did his stand-up, too. He did stand-up as his monologue. Here's what he said he happened when he walked into the writer's room in 2016 when he hosted after Trump won. Cut 37.
When they called Donald Trump the winner, that shut the writer's room down. You should have seen them
the first
in there.
One or the second?
The first one. Boy, the first they was one, yeah, crying yeah. Like yeah. Black people.
Yeah.
That's kidding.
Bro,
they're not like black people, but you know what I mean? They couldn't believe that this was happening.
And remember, Dave Chappelle came out and said, we just give this guy a chance at least. And he does a whole thing about how Trump handles things almost like rappers handle things. He does it straight on and he calls people out and he calls them names very similar to. In fact, we might even have that when he came out and said to give the president a chance. But Dave Chappelle, I mean, that's interesting, too, because that's really what you heard, because Lorne Michaels in his book, and my son read his book and was telling me about it, is that they have all these protests about different people that were coming on. They don't like certain things they said. These writers wouldn't show up for a week. Wait, you're a 28-year-old writer with a this is the break, or a 23-year-old writer. This is the break of a lifetime. You're writing on SNL. Excuse me, I don't politically like where our guest stands. I'm not going to show up for a week. They just talk about how things have totally changed. Also, comedians, in many respects, are the tip of the spear. They say the politically incorrect thing. Now they're sitting in that room like Harvard grads, like Yale protesters, and they're making these statements. I'm not going to write comedy for this man or this woman. Crazy.
Insane, because they really have, like, if you become a writer on SNL in that world, like, that is almost the peak, right, of getting that. At the same time, a lot of those writers end up coming from pretty affluent families from the Ivy League schools. So you know where their mindset is. Not all. Some of them are just that talented and work their way up.
Right. The other one that keeps in mind is Jason Sudeikis. Yeah, the guy who plays, you know,
from Ted Lasso.
From Ted Lasso. He was mocking Joe Biden on the stage. When it looked like Biden was getting buried, would not have the nomination, gets crushed in New Hampshire, gets crushed in Iowa. They go to South Carolina, and they have an SNL. And they just talk about this guy who lost his mind, gets confused, screams things out. And all of a sudden, he gets the nomination. Sudeikis doesn't get the job. He's nowhere near that set. And they come in with the same guy that plays Trump. Because why? Because they just made him seem like a guy who talks low.
And if they were truly cared about comedy, they would have kept Sudeikis because he was so good. He did it so well that
right.
One or two times.
And when it looks like Biden's cratering and he's not running again, in comes Dana Carvey. Why? Because Dana Carvey's already been on his podcast, been on with Howard Stern, ripping Biden, mocking him with his fantastic impression. But guess what? An impression that doesn't make you look good, like a lot of impressions with comedians making fun of politicians. But that's how SNL got off track. And then everybody's suspicion underlined. Dave Chappelle, they cried when Trump won.
He said what everyone knew, right?
Absolutely.
They came out basically all in black after he won.
I will say this. I will talk about that for my WHIO listeners on the 21st of June on History, Liberty, Laughs. Go to BrianKilmeade.com and more.
Fox News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Yes, very approachable. Yes, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Brian Kilmeade coming your direction. A beautiful summer day here where the air quality not great. Thank you, Canada. You're burning your forests again. Josh Krasshour, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider, joins us shortly. Get a perspective on Israel, the IDF, and some of the bad reporting coming out of Gaza. Mark Thiessen will be with us today, former presidential speechwriter, best-selling author, editor, also former, and he's also a Fox News contributor. And we got a lot going on today, including the Chancellor of Germany makes his first visit as Chancellor to the White House. Those Oval Office visits are often the most entertaining thing you can hear at any moment at any time. So before we get to that, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This is of a piece with the president seeming to imagine that this man, Putin, with whom he says he has a great relationship, is a man of peace. The evidence of that, it seems to me, particularly at this point, is extremely thin.
That is Britt Hume being very pragmatic. They can win, Mr. President. Ukraine's daring double attacks on bridges, trains, and military bases shows you Russia may be thugs, but when it comes to their military, they are not studs. Kind of rhymes.
Number two.
This is really something what's happened. We've created over 500,000 new jobs in a short period of time, secured nearly $15 trillion, new dollars, new investments that are going into our country.
One big, beautiful bill gets roasted by Musk and propelled forward by Thune, Johnson, and Trump. We look at the explosive term, defining legislation.
Number one.
I really have thought long and hard about this, is to follow my own compass. I think we need to stop thinking in boxes and think outside of our boxes and not be so partisan.
That makes sense. She's a great linguist. It's time to think in boxes, but outside of boxes. KJP is a baffling announcement. The worst press secretary in American history leaves her party and is out to blow up, I think, Joe Biden and all her co-workers. We examine, along with the push to investigate the Otto Penn presidency. And by the way, Joe Biden just weighed in and says, of course I signed all those things myself where I approved the Otto Penn. Mark Thiessen joins us now. Mark, first off, we have so much to talk about on KJP. Saying essentially the broken presidency, turning on her party. What can you put this in perspective? Does it remind you of any moment in recent history outside Scott McClellan, who had legitimate issues and, you know, he blew up the Bush White House and probably regrets it? I can't believe this one.
Well, first of all, you know, she says that they have to think outside of boxes. I'd like to see her think outside of a binder.
Yes.
That's something she was fairly was unable to do from the podium. The literally dumb as a bucket of rocks, the worst press secretary in the history of our country, couldn't speak in complete sentences. I think she referred to like bipartisan, bicameral legislation because she didn't know what bicameral meant. This is the White House press secretary. She would say she would read stuff. I mean, she was like the perfect press secretary for Joe Biden because she would read stuff that she didn't understand and say things that she had no idea what she was saying. So she and Biden were kind of a match, except she didn't have the excuse of age for her cognitive.
So here is the subtitle, A Look Inside a Broken White House. So I assume she's going to blow up Biden. And then people say, no, she's not. So they say Democratic groups are chatting back and forth and saying how they wanted her to quit. Anita Dunn tried to get her to leave. Jeff Zients wanted to nudge her out. They lined up other jobs for her. She was jealous of Admiral Kirby and wouldn't let him pick her own reporters to answer. So basically, now everybody that was holding their fire because she was a black lesbian are going after her.
Yeah. I mean, so she the only reason that John Kirby was not the White House spokesman was because he was a white male and they weren't going to fire a black female, especially a LGBT black female from the job. It's the same reason they got Kamala Harris as the vice president, as the presidential nominee, because because the party of identity politics was not going to kick the first black woman vice president to the curb. So they went to the mat with her and it really worked out, didn't it? They're paying the price for their identity politics, but instead of learning the lesson, and promoting talent and doing it on merit, they're doubling down on stupidity.
What would you do for Republicans and the whole Otto Penn controversy and the oversight investigation? You're never going to get Joe Biden to testify. You're never going to get the Politburo to admit that he was lost it. Do you feel as though this might be a loss before it starts, or you think it's worth the investigation?
It has to be investigated. I mean, this is the biggest political cover up in my lifetime. The fact the president was more mentally compromised and incapable of doing the job, and that a bunch of unelected aides, you know, I mean, not since Woodrow Wilson had a stroke and his wife was essentially the president have we had a situation like this. And look, I think it's a disqualifier for anybody in the cabinet, any of these people who want to run for president. You know, I think that shuts them out. But you know, the truth is that with the people who I actually want to investigate are the Jake Tappers of the world. You know, the people, Biden is gone. His aides are gone. They're all out in the wilderness. They're still, you know, Jake Tapper's running around reporting on this like he's like, you know, he's Bob Woodward, you know, discovering Watergate. You know, where were you when this was all happening? You know, I've got a basic standard for who I take seriously on this issue. Were you talking about it before the debate or after the debate? If you're talking about it after the debate, you were just doing CYA and trying to save your party from an electoral defeat. If you're talking about this before the debate, you can be taken seriously. The Annie Linskys of the world who reported on this, you know, I just drove my daughter, I picked her up from school and had like an 8-hour drive each way. So I actually read Jake Tapper's book. And what's amazing is how he talks about, you know, how some in the media, you know, trash the Annie Linsky Wall Street Journal story. It's like, yeah, Olivier Darcy at CNN did. You talked about how, you know, well, the Wall Street Journal is funded by Rupert Murdoch and News Corp, you know, on the air. You were trashing it. So was your network. You know, and there's no self-reflection whatsoever. This is why credibility of the media is absolutely in the tank. Why most Americans believe that the media is completely biased is because Russia collusion conspiracy theory, total lie. They pushed it. Steele dossier, they pushed it. The Hunter Biden laptop, they suppressed it. Joe Biden cognitive decline. How dare you make fun of his stutter? It's like they're political hacks. And until they change, no one's going to believe them.
Anyone who believes they're going to change hasn't paid attention to the cancer diagnosis. They said that he just got cancer the other day. Really? No one believes that. No one believes no one could be that irresponsible to not get a prostate exam while holding the highest office since 2014. So they're still lying to you.
I had the same health care that Joe Biden did when I was at the White House, right? Yeah. So if you're a member of the senior staff, they took me to Walter Reed. When I became a member of the senior staff, they took me to Walter Reed, and they did every test known to man on me. Because I had not been taking care of myself. Every blood test, I had a colonoscopy. I had, you know, the PSA test. I had everything done to me. I had the same care that Joe Biden did. If they missed the fact that he has stage 4 metastatic cancer, then that is, you know, either they're the worst doctors in the world and the worst healthcare system of the world, or somebody's lying.
Lying. Man, there's so many things. You have this great column on Chinese in our higher, you know, what should we be doing with foreign students when it comes to our education, highest education? You say Stanford is a case study on how Beijing infiltrates U.S. universities. In what way?
So the editors of the two reporters at the Stanford Review, which is a conservative student newspaper at Stanford, did probably what the Washington Post and the New York Times and other newspapers should have done, is they actually investigated Chinese infiltration of Stanford. And they interviewed a lot of these Chinese students who are on campus. And what they told them is, yeah, I've got a handler. And the handler, I have to check in once a week with the handler, and I have to hand over my research reports, and I have to report on what I'm doing in my lab, and I have to hand in the results of my lab work, and I have to hand in, and I also have to report on other Chinese nationals to say to tell them if they're saying anything in favor of the Dalai Lama or critical of China while they're over here. It's the Chinese students. Some of them do it willingly because they want to get ahead, but some of them it's international repression where the Chinese Ministry of State Security, if they don't turn in their reports, their families get hauled into the police station in China, and then they call them from the police station. We have your parents here. Are you going to turn in your report? So this is a huge spying network that's been created. Some of them want to do it. Some of them are being forced to do it, but it's a threat to our national security.
Okay. And by the way, that's why the president says we had a pullback on the 150,000 Chinese students, especially at our elite education. They call Harvard the party school, not because they party, but because it's a communist party, sends their kids there. So I want to go
like that.
I want to go to Ukraine. I want to go to Ukraine. Very few people know more about what's going on than you in the country. Here's Britt Hume on the brilliance of these military operations and who Vladimir Putin really is. Cut 16.
In the midst of efforts by President Trump to broker a ceasefire, which whose terms Ukraine has repeatedly agreed to, Putin has not agreed to much of anything. He sent a delegation to Istanbul that basically did nothing. He has now stepped up his attacks on civilians in Ukraine, in response to which Ukraine, by the most ingenious methods, attacks what are unmistakably military targets inside Russia. Now Putin says, well, I'm going to have to respond to that, as if to say to the president, well, Mr. President, I'm sorry, but, you know, we can talk about peace later. But in the meantime, I got to respond to this. And the president, although there may be things in this call that we don't know about, but based on what his statement said, he seems to think, well, okay, then we'll deal with it later. This is of a piece with the president seeming to imagine that this man, Putin, with whom he says he has a great relationship, is a man of peace. The evidence of that, it seems to me, particularly at this point, is extremely thin.
Your thoughts. Is there more than we need to know?
So this is, first of all, this is the greatest military operation since Bibi Netanyahu and the pager operation.
Followed up by the walkie-talkies.
So ingenious. And the wall followed by the walkie-talkies. This was, and you know what? There may be a walkie-talkie attack coming too. So this may not be over yet. They planned this for over a year. It's just in execution, it's brilliant, number one. Number two, they had every right to do it because these were the planes that they were using to bomb to launch missiles at civilian residential neighborhoods, the very attacks that Donald Trump has been outraged by. You know, and so Ukraine has every right to defend itself. And three, this gives Trump leverage. The Ukrainians do, because the Putin is, you know, he sits there and he gets on the phone with Trump. And while he's on the phone with Trump, they launch a bombing campaign on Kyiv, attacking residential neighborhoods, killing dozens of civilians, targeting civilians. He's laughing at him. And he thinks that he's got the momentum. And now the Ukrainians have momentum. Now the Ukrainians are on the offensive, and they're striking deep into Russia and causing him pain. That gives Trump leverage at the negotiating table. He should support these kinds of attacks, because if Putin's going to do it, you know, then why should Zelensky have to sit back and take it, you know, while he's waiting for Putin to come around and support peace that he's never going to do?
What about the detonation of the bridge underwater?
Love it. Love it. And, you know, the other thing that, you know, the innovation that Ukraine has had in warfare is going to affect the world beyond, like, the Ukrainians, for example, have taken out half of the Russian Black Sea fleet. They don't have a navy. They did it with sea drones. They sunk the Moskva, the pride of the Black Sea fleet. The Russian Navy has had to pull back from Ukrainian waters because they're afraid that their navy is going to get destroyed. You know who's watching that? Taiwan. Because the Chinese Navy has to get across the Taiwan Strait to reach Taiwan if they want to invade them. Taiwan doesn't need to have bombers and fighter jets to stop that. They just need the same sea drones that the Ukrainians built that they were using to take out the Chinese Navy in the same way. So this attack, what's happening with these bomber attacks, this is going to transform warfare in a way that's going to be in our favor for a long time to come.
So Vladimir Putin vows a retaliation. No kidding. That's called 3 years. What were you holding back from?
He's not been holding back. What escalation could he possibly do? He's been escalating he's been escalating for 3 years, and he's been escalating especially in the last few months while Trump's trying to get him to talk to peace. And I will tell you something. I don't think it's a coincidence that yesterday Donald Trump at 1:56 tweeted out a post about his conversation with Putin. And at 2:01, he tweeted out saying Congress needs to give me a sanctions bill so that I have leverage with Putin at the negotiating table. Something happened in that conversation that made Trump realize I need leverage to force this guy to the table and coerce him into peace, because he's not going to go willingly. And I think Congress needs to respond to that and pass the sanctions bill and give Trump the leverage he needs to crush the Russian economy if Putin doesn't agree to peace.
I'll tell you what, NATO has stepped up. This new chancellor of Germany is going to put more money into defense for real. I look forward to that meeting today, because he's also developing long-range missiles to give to Ukraine to hit deeper into Russia. Unlike Joe Biden, this guy's not scared. Mark, lastly, the Grand Ayatollah has turned down the last peace initiative, or the nuclear initiative, from Steve Witkoff. to get rid of the nuclear program and enrich down to zero. What are we waiting for?
You know, look, I completely support Donald Trump doing everything he can to resolve this peacefully, because nobody wants to have to do this militarily. But the reality is there may be no option but the military option. And Iran is incredibly weak right now. They've never been more vulnerable. Their air defenses are down. Their ballistic missile capability has been taken out. All their terror proxies are on their heels. They've lost Syria and their pipeline for weapons. They've never been in a position, one, more vulnerable to a military attack, and two, less capable of retaliating for a military attack. And that window will close eventually. So I want to do it peacefully, but if we have to do it militarily, and all these people running around saying, oh, we're going to start another war in the Middle East like Iraq. It's like, did Trump start another war in the Middle East when he took out Qasem Soleimani?
Yeah.
No. No one's talking about sending U.S. troops into Iran to overthrow the regime and set up a coalition provisional authority.
Gotcha.
That's not something anybody is discussing. We're talking about eliminating their nuclear program. Period. Full stop. And that's a doable thing.
Yes. If you go on their word, then they get sanctions relief and they give more money to Hezbollah and Hamas. We're back to where we started. This just
exactly.
In, Chinese President Xi on Thursday held a phone call with President Trump at the latter's request, that according to the Chinese embassy in the U.S. More on that in just a moment. Mark, always fascinating talking to you. Go get him.
Talking to you, Brian. Take care.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, we are back. And by the way, I see all the phones up there from Pensacola to New Jersey to St. Louis. We'll get to you in about 15 minutes. But coming up next, Josh Kroshauer. I got to get his perspective on the anti-Semitic attacks in Boulder, what happened the week before in Washington, D.C., the burning of the governor's house over in Pennsylvania. And now there's a big push to get rid of the shooter's the flamethrower's family. Why not? They all overstayed their visa. The leader of the family, obviously with evil intent, literally burned a 88-year-old Holocaust victim in real time in the afternoon. All plotted and planned. Had to know with the family. And if the family did know their dad was twisted and they weren't twisted, they're complicit because they did not turn him in. But of course, the courts hold up the whole procedure. But that's what's got to happen. And for Hakeem Jeffries to come out and say, well, ICE covers their faces and should be stopped, you totally got it backwards.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Does the president have the stamina, physically and mentally, do you think, to continue on even after 2024?
Don, you're asking me this question. Oh, my gosh. He's the president of the United States. You know, I can't even keep up with him.
How is President Biden ever going to convince the 75% of voters who are worried about his physical and mental health that he is okay, even though in Las Vegas he told a story about recently talking to a French president who died in 1996?
I'm not even going to go down that rabbit hole with you,
what?
Sir.
What is
I mean, look, that was, as I said, it was a cheap, a cheap fake. That was definitely a cheap fake. It was.
It wasn't. He mentioned Mitterrand as president of France, and there were no cheap fakes. It was him freezing, all right? So it gets chronicled in a book, and now there's about to be another book, and this press secretary, the worst ever, KJP, is about to put a book called The Independent, The Broken... the story behind the broken White House. Broken White House. So obviously he's going after Biden, you would think. Or she's going to go after everyone but Biden, which means everybody, because he was totally isolated outside his family. And believe me, knowing Joe Biden might have been a benefit at one point, but it's not now. Now it's a career killer. Josh Kroshauer, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. Josh, our head was spinning after CNN anchor decides he suddenly realizes that Joe Biden lost his mind and has been propped up by his Politburo, not even by his cabinet secretaries. And then he goes and sells the book. Well, just when your mind is twisted and you're trying to get a hold of this, out comes KJP with leaving the party and her war on the Democratic Party, which she vociferously defended, including the president. Can you put this in perspective at any point in history?
Well, look, it's interesting. This is another example of how people whispering behind the scenes and really, like, again, the mainstream media probably talked about the lack of qualifications that KJP brought to the job and the absurd exaggerations about Biden's health and fitness that you just played there, Brian, in contrast to the reality. I mean, we talked about this on the show all the time. You know, Fox covered everything all the time in real time, and for somehow it didn't really penetrate a lot of the mainstream media, and now it comes out. Now you're seeing, especially those in Biden world, I saw this Axios story by Alex Thompson, who's the co-author of that book, quoting by top-level Biden officials saying how incompetent she was, she didn't know how to manage a team, she didn't know how to shape or deliver a message, she created more problems than she solved. Now it's coming out. I mean, this is sort of what's so frustrating to a lot of people, kind of as media watchers. These are things that were talked about privately, but because they didn't want to offend the press secretary, they didn't want to have any hard feelings, they basically pulled their punches. And now we find out after she comes out with this book, that sounds like it's going to really burn a lot of bridges with her, between her and the Democratic Party leaders.
I mean, evidently she tried out for The View. She couldn't even get an audition. You know, she can't get hired. They tried to give her a job just to get her out of the White House. She's so terrible. She was a professional black lesbian. That's what she was. She kept leaning on that. When things got tough, are you really going to get rid of the first black lesbian? Here is Alex Thompson talking about the cheap fakes and all that stuff that was going on behind the scenes in his book.
So when we were reporting the book, I remember talking to fairly senior White House person, and they were like, they basically admitted, like, yes, he was bad. Yes, we shouldn't have run him again. Yes, like, he was really struggling. But they sort of got in my face. They were like, you guys, like, bought some of our spin. And they specifically mentioned the cheap fake stuff. They were like, this person was like, we could not, at least they were speaking for themselves. They were like, I could not believe we got those stories placed.
So he's mocking the press for buying their lies.
Yeah, look, Brian.
Not Alex Thompson, but the official talking Alex Thompson.
Well, and look, and Alex is, I think, has been very candid about this, that many of his colleagues in the media covering the White House dropped the ball. I mean, well, one of the things, lessons I learned early on in my journalism career is that the stuff that's talked about at the water cooler, the conversation behind the scenes is the story. And the fact that so many people, I think, even in real time, knew about sort of the lack of qualifications. There was a lot of whispering. If you remember, Brian, there, you know, John Kirby, who often briefed the press about national security issues, was much more authoritative, did a much better job. There was some reporting at the time, so there was some anonymous reporting that, you know, that there was tension between Karine Jean-Pierre and John Kirby. White House denied it, but that was out there. But, you know, the subtext was that she just was not really helping Biden out and was making these ridiculous exaggerations. And the cheap fake moment is one that's going to live in infamy, because we saw in real time how, you know, we saw the video of that fundraiser where Biden was incapacitated.
Yeah.
It was kind of embarrassing. And yet there was, if you listen to the briefing in the days after, they kind of, a lot of folks ran with this whole cheap fakes narrative, which was absurd. It was what Karine Jean-Pierre said, but it should have been treated a whole lot more critically and skeptically. We all have our own eyes and we can make independent judgments ourselves. So that was a real embarrassing moment, but for everyone. And the fact that some of these exaggerations and absurd bouts of spin were taken seriously, not a good moment for the press.
So according to a White House staffer, she made a joke about being independent last year, and now it's a book. All ideas are monetary, even dumb ones. Another former administration official says everyone thinks this is a grift. And then Simone Sanders, used to work for the vice president, said a lot of group chats were revived today. And why? Because a lot of people were extremely critical of her behind the scenes, and she was somewhat of a tyrant behind the scenes. They said, according to 7 former Biden administration officials granted anonymity to describe private conversation, said this is an attention-grabbing ploy, and is to light up different Democratic operatives and go on the offensive. Quote, she has detonated long-simmering grievances among her former White House colleagues, in pursuit of celebrity and a personal media exposure while serving as then President Joe Biden's press secretary. And we know that she was always getting these profiles, but never anything of substance. The problem with her is she didn't know anything. She couldn't ad-lib anything, and she was buried in a binder because she knew nothing about the policies fundamentally as well as the president's decision. Where Jen Psaki kind of knew this stuff. She could have probably done a better job than Biden. Whatever you think of it, she understood the issues.
Yeah, Jen was a pro. Most people in that job are professionals. Not everyone, but a lot of people have to have a certain set of qualifications. It's a tough job. It's not easy. There were other roles, I think, in the White House that would have been better suited for her. But I think it tells you a lot that she kind of, and this is some of the anonymous background commentary is noting that she didn't get a job on The View. Usually, if you're in that role, you may become a commentator on television. Maybe you become a lobbyist for a corporation and do their public affairs like a Jay Carney does. Usually writing a tell-all book is sort of the last refuge of someone who just can't really hack it in other places. I remember in the Bush administration, like Scott McClellan was sort of in that role back in the day, wrote a book and didn't make a whole lot of friends. Even if it was a good book, writing a tell-all is never comfortable because usually you're kind of calling out people you don't like and it creates a lot of uncomfortable situations. So, it does sound like she didn't have a whole lot of offers in the private sector on television, and this was sort of her last resort to try to make some money and have a post-political career.
Let's talk about Iran. The June 4th, Ali, the Supreme Leader, rejected the recent U.S. nuclear proposal because the proposal would require Iran eventually hold all uranium enrichment, and that's a red line for them. What are we still talking about?
Yeah, there's this real kind of kabuki game going on, and I think the real concern both in Congress with a lot of Republicans I've talked to in Congress and heard from, as well as in the Middle East and specifically, Israel's leadership and national security officials are very concerned that not only is there's this debate over enrichment, and Trump has sort of posted on Truth Social that they're not going to have enrichment capability, but there are other leaks coming out that suggest there may be some ability for Iran to handle enrichment. So that the other part of the game is that Iran is trying to buy time. They're trying to restore their defenses of some of their nuclear programs that were destroyed by Israel last year. And the more this goes on, the more like we have these meetings that seem to go nowhere week after week after week. The more Iran is empowered, and the less that can be done to deter their nuclear program that they are rapidly making inroads on. So I think that is also a big part of the story. It's one thing to deal with the negotiations and figure out like what exactly is going to be in these agreements. The other thing is that Iran is probably, they see the fact that this is going nowhere, but they're still buying time, and they still see the Trump officials coming to the table week after week without a whole lot of progress. Trump has said that, if we don't get a deal, that the military options on the table, and that's going to be what happens. But I think that he's very reticent to do that in actuality, and I think it's just easier to buy time, even though that creates the opportunity for Iran to become more empowered.
What do your sources say? How long is the Prime Minister Netanyahu going to wait? Is he in a box?
Well, I think he is in a box because first of all, I think there's a question of what Israel can do without some degree of U.S. support militarily if they did decide to go ahead with a strike against the Iranian nuclear facilities. And secondly, if they didn't, Trump has said he wants Netanyahu to hold back. He said that publicly about a week ago. So if Netanyahu essentially defied Trump, I think that could cause a whole lot of other problems in the U.S.-Israel relationship that I don't think Netanyahu wants to gamble with. So it's a very challenging time, I think. The expectations of the foreign policy views and vision of the Trump administration were once seen to be more like the first term, where Trump had a whole lot of successes in the Middle East, the Abraham Accords, and really going after Soleimani, one of the big terror leaders in Iran, and other similar successes. The people advising Trump are a whole lot different in the second term, and they're at the very least advising more caution, against any kind of military activity in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, look, if he respects Tom Cotton knows they got to be taken out. If he respects Marco Rubio, the senator, he knows Iran's got to be taken out. They cannot be trusted to live up to a deal nor sign off on a deal that the American public would agree with. And then you have a situation where J.D. Vance thinks that NATO's the problem and Iran, and that maybe Israel's the problem. So I just think at one point President Trump will use his right instincts and understand that by extending these talks, putting the whole region and the Abraham Accords extension in jeopardy, Iran is the problem.
Yeah, I mean, and I think Trump's record, and especially in the first term, speaks for itself. But you're right; he is getting advice from a different, more isolationist side of the party that was not, doesn't really represent the majority of Republicans in Congress. Doesn't even represent, I think, most people in this administration. But you mentioned Vice President Vance, Tulsi Gabbard. These are people on the left, at least in Gabbard's case, she was a Democrat not that long ago, and she had the same position as a Democrat. So there are people on the left, I think, that are kind of trying to immerse themselves into the administration and give Trump different advice than what he got in the first term.
Let's talk about the anti-Semitism on campus and what's happening with Harvard. The president says no more international students are suing back. He's trying to take the accreditation away from Columbia. Here's Jonathan Epstein, the Israeli embassy shooting witness, about what he's seen, former Columbia student, Cut 34.
I think we need to ask, where did this guy come from and where was he inspired? People don't fall from the sky just hating Jews, shooting Jews, okay? He clearly is listening to the very loud and visible protests at places like Columbia. He clearly is listening to very loud and visible members of Congress, certain members of Congress. And we ask, why are they inspiring him and whether they plan to continue inspiring people like him?
So they're talking about the shooter over in Boulder. They're talking about the shooter over in D.C. Where's this coming from? And do you agree with the president when he says, I'm kicking out the whole family over in Boulder?
Well, look, I think he had, I mean, these are illegal immigrants. They're, as I understand it, they're not here. None of the family is here. It's not like he had the kids when he was in the state. These are all folks who came here illegally. So I think there's a lot. I mean, aside from what the judge ruled yesterday, it does seem like there's a lot of legal precedent that if you're not here legally, and there may be, we'll find out, but there may be connections, family member connections to this awful crime. That's certainly something I think that most Americans would be fine with, deporting the family. And this is, we'll see where that goes. There's certainly a due process, and the legal process is going to have to wear itself out. But I don't think there's a whole lot of sympathy for the family of a person who's here illegally, who committed a horrible hate crime against Jews in Boulder.
Do you support what the president's been doing with higher education and the anti-Semitism?
Well, I think the test will be where do things land next year, right? I mean, if you break a few eggs, but you actually eliminate or really roll back the anti-Semitism and the extreme, these are, as you mentioned, Brian, this just didn't come out of nowhere. These are like chants and views and ideologies that have been festering on these college campuses. You just go to any of these, encampments that were in place last year, go to any of these anti-Israel rallies, and you hear globalize the intifada, commonplace. You hear, the from the river to the sea chants. Those are the same chants that inspired a lot of the most heinous anti-Semitic crimes that we've seen in this country in recent months. So, and including the murders in D.C., we heard the guy there saying free Palestine after committing these heinous murders, Boulder. You just look at the guy's social media. So there's a direct connection between the two. I think there's a lot of willingness to let the administration, at least the Jewish community, to let the administration take some tough measures, but hopefully Harvard will follow suit. Hopefully that there's an ability to strike some compromise where if Harvard and Columbia are willing to crack down on the worst anti-Semitism, maybe they'll
give an offer. Someone's got to tell Harvard by suing, you're making things worse. I don't care if they get some wins in court. This is turbulence. If you're an international student, you're thinking about studying, doing studies there, or if you're thinking about doing any tests or any research, you got to be saying to yourself, I got to try somewhere else. I have to have some certainty.
Yeah. And sadly, you still see the graduation speakers at Harvard and some of these other elite schools. They're still tolerating and indulging some of the most, disturbing rhetoric when it comes to anti-Israel rhetoric and when it comes to anti-Semitism. So,
gotcha.
They say they're doing small things, but the proof will be in the pudding, and next year will be a big test for some of these schools.
Go get him, Josh Krasauer. Appreciate it. This just in, President Trump just put this on Truth Social. I just concluded a good talk phone call with President Xi of China discussing some of the intricacies of a recently made and agreed to trade deal. The call lasted approximately 1.5 hours, resulted in very positive conclusion for both countries. There no longer be any questions respecting the complexity of rare earth products, or respective teams will be meeting shortly at a location to be determined. We will be represented by Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent. And he goes on a little bit more. More on that in a moment. So a lot of moving parts. Chancellor of Germany shortly. A lot going on. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Did the Chinese spy scandal hurt your credibility? Or did Republicans just weaponize like a nothing burger, so to speak?
You know, the fact that the FBI and the House Ethics Committee said it was like, I would hope that would be enough. But like in a disinformation society, like I recognize that it's everyone on the right's favorite meme. And frankly, I think a lot of Republicans look at me as like, oh, that's a straight, white, Christian male son of a cop. It's more betrayal to them. Like I've heard that from them on their side, that's why they take it so personally.
I think he's so in love with himself, Eric Swalwell, along with Charlemagne. He's so clueless. By the way, the House Ethics Committee exonerated him because it was a Democratic Ethics Committee. Put him up front now. Problem is, he had a relationship, maybe unknowingly, with a Chinese spy. Long relationship. And then that Chinese spy had him hire another intern. Fang Fang. So this all happened. You didn't get exonerated from anything. And believe me, nobody or no Republican thinks about Eric Swalwell. Because your dad's a cop, you said you overcame things and you're playing with house money. What is wrong with having a dad that is a cop? Great benefits, respect in the community, certainty with your job. That's not overcoming obstacles, genius. Quick follow-up with President Trump and his message from the call with China. They have promised to exchange visits with each other. He accepted an invitation to China.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. Brian Kilmeade Show, moving your direction. The final hour of the week on Thursday. David Mamet's here, award-winning playwright, author of the new book, The Disenlightenment, Politics, Horror, and Entertainment. Bottom of the hour. Get the Democratic perspective from Julian Epstein shortly. Before we really get started, though, as we try to follow the breaking news, the Chancellor of Germany's in town at the White House. Be meeting in the Oval Office. I imagine they'll open up the cameras. It'll go for about an hour. It'll be endlessly intriguing. Maybe argumentative. I think they get along on quite a few things. Next, we also have a meeting that just wrapped up between a phone call between President Xi and President Trump. Lasted at least 90 minutes, where each other invited each other to their country, and they both accepted with their wives. So the market likes that. It's up 68 points. Not going crazy, but there is no trade deal yet today. It would be great. This would cap off the president's day to have a trade deal. Whether it's EU, I think that Jameson Greer is over in the EU now, or whether it's Japan or India, would certainly help. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This is of a piece with the president seeming to imagine that this man, Putin, with whom he says he has a great relationship, is a man of peace. The evidence of that, it seems to me, particularly at this point, is extremely thin.
You think so? I think so, too, Britt. They can win, Mr. President. Ukraine daring double attacks on bridges, trains, and military bases shows you Russia may be thugs, but they are not military studs.
Number two.
This is really something what's happened. We've created over 500,000 new jobs in a short period of time. Secured nearly $15 trillion, new investments that are going into our country.
But the president's not happy with the jobs numbers. It was on the Fed to lower interest rates like they've done eight times in Europe. One big, beautiful bill gets roasted by Musk and propelled forward by Thune, Johnson, and Trump. We'll look at the explosive term-defining legislation.
Number one.
I really have thought long and hard about this, is to follow my own compass. I think we need to stop thinking in boxes and think outside of our boxes and not be so partisan.
Wait. Think in boxes, but outside of boxes? What? KJP is baffling announcement. The worst press secretary in American history leaves her party to blow up Biden, I guess, and all his friends. We examine along with a push to investigate the auto pen presidency, which, by the way, President Biden out of nowhere just says, of course I signed everything. If not with if I didn't sign directly, he gave permission to use the auto pen. Let's bring in Julian Epstein. You can watch him on Zoom BrianKilmeadeShow.com. If you go to Fox News and you just scroll over, you can see the video. Julian, welcome back. So here we go again. Just when you think the explosive book by Tapper and Thompson caught you by surprise from the left, now we have the press secretary leaving her party. What's your reaction?
I think it's a gimmick, Brian. I think that once you got through with the White House, most people in Democratic circles thought they would never hire her for a press secretary position. I think inside the White House, she was widely regarded as incompetent and unprepared. She sort of had the Kamala Harris problem, which is she wasn't particularly good at answering questions. So everything was either a cliche or reading from a binder. But she was obviously very insecure with respect to John Kirby on the podium. She didn't like when he was on the podium because she sort of felt that he outshined her. But I think inside the White House, there was a widespread view that she just wasn't up for the job. So the only people that were ever loyal to her were the sort of the hard party line insiders. And the fact that she's rejecting them now, you know, it's sort of she's got no constituency left. So I think this may be sort of about she feels like she was rejected internally. So she was going to reject them, sort of about her own personal self-redemption. But this is, I think, more just a gimmick to get some type of podium after post-White House. But it looks silly because she was ultimately the wanting to be the insider's insider. So her distancing from the party, she never indicated any kind of independent thought whatsoever that would be consistent with this.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't know the issues, and she wasn't in the meetings. Yeah. And now we find out there probably were no meetings that she missed. Listen to her in action. Remember, knowing what you know now, she says inside the story, inside a broken White House, knowing what we know now and know her new stance. Listen to this. Cut three.
Well, he also said he's sharpest before 8 p.m. So say that the Pentagon at some point picks up an incoming nuke. It's 11 p.m. Who do you call? The First Lady?
He has a team that lets him know of any news that is pertinent and important to the American people.
Who ordered White House officials to cover up a declining president?
I know that that is a narrative that you love. First of all, there's been no cover-up. I want to be very clear about that.
Okay, there was. Huge. Exposed. She's lying. Press secretary stretched the truth. But now we know she says inside a broken White House. What was broken about the White House, Julian, that she's going to confess in a way that will make people think more of her?
Well, I'm all ears. I mean, I think the I want to know what she thinks was broken. She was the North Star of the cover-up. I think her credibility now, when it was so obvious, I mean, she was saying he was doing handstands in the Oval Office. When sort of everybody knew that this was the big lie of 2024, everybody knew Biden wasn't up to the job. That's the funny thing about the cover-up, was that the elites inside the White House really thought they could fool the public, but the public was never fooled. And it shows you at the same time an arrogance and a complete lack of being in touch with just what the American people are thinking. The dysfunction of the White House, Brian, if you ask me, was that they just never understood where the American people were on any of the issues on immigration, crime, inflation, you name it. You know, I always tell people to watch your network. I always tell Democrats, watch Fox News. Don't watch CNN. Don't watch MSNBC. Because if you go back to 2021, Brian, Fox was right. And this isn't just, you know, a shameless plug. But Fox was right on Afghanistan. Fox was right on crime. Fox was right on immigration. Fox was right on crime, sort of on down the list.
Russia,
in terms of flagging
laptop,
these as big
dossier.
Issues. Laptop. Flagging these and covering these as big issues that the American people did care about. And all of the polling sort of bears the network out in terms of covering the issues that people cared about, as opposed to, you know, MSNBC, CNN, and some of the other legacy networks that were sort of sweeping these things under the rug. So Yeah, I'm dying to hear what she thinks was dysfunctional. It was obvious to most of us which was what was dysfunctional, which was we didn't have a commander in chief that was capable of doing the job. And the party had adopted these sort of neo-Marxist leftist positions of big statism and sort of the woke idea of there's oppressors and oppressed and everything, all of democratic policymaking is animated from that worldview, which is a worldview that nobody believes in other than progressive elites.
So, Julian, here's an example. So she's doing a terrible job as press secretary. You fire her. Trump has no problem doing that. He had, say, good friend Mike Waltz. I think he would have done a great job if he stayed, but he makes the decision, you're gone. Reince Priebus, you're my press secretary. You helped me get elected, but you're gone. That's it. I have to make a move. Secretary of Defense Mattis, Bolton, whatever, you're gone. They are afraid in the White House to fire a press secretary because she's a black lesbian. They're afraid to get rid of the vice president because she's a woman of color, even though she's done a terrible job and she's lazy and she doesn't provide legitimate backup for the president of the United States, who people are questioning anyway. It would have made the ticket stronger had they put Josh Shapiro there or anybody with some talent at the number two spot, Governor Whitmer. But they can't do it because she's a woman of color. The political correctness was their undoing. Hillary Clinton runs for office. She's my pick. That means we have to get rid of anybody else from Bernie Sanders on down. RFK says that he wants to run against Biden. They said we're going to move the primary to make it a primary that Biden could win in South Carolina. So every time they put their hand on the scale and don't let meritocracy win, they pay the price.
I wish I had something to add to that. I think you just said it beautifully. I mean, this is called being hoisted on your own petard. And we saw lots of examples of where wokeness or political correctness or sort of the DEI trap ended up crushing the Democrats. And this is sort of this is their very soul. This is their very heart and soul. This idea that they are, you know, emancipating a previously oppressed and marginalized peoples. Although you go down, you look at, you poll the black community, you poll the brown community, and, you know, just take policing, for example, which was the big George Floyd animating issue. Yeah. Even after George Floyd, and certainly today, most black and brown voters trust the police.
But listen to this, Julian. I got something for you. So every time you bring that up now to Democrats outside people like you, they say, I never said that. That was just fringe, a part of our party. Then I watch Hakeem Jeffries this morning when it comes to ICE. What's their job? To crack down on illegal immigrant criminals, people that have overstayed their visas. But listen to Hakeem Jeffries.
Every single ICE agent who's engaged in this aggressive overreach and are trying to hide their identities from the American people will be unsuccessful in doing that. This is America. This is not the Soviet Union. We're not behind the Iron Curtain. This is not the 1930s. And every single one of them, no matter what it takes, no matter how long it takes, will, of course, be identified.
He's going to identify ICE agents who cover their face just like they do with gang units do, because they don't want their family doxxed and they don't want their job following them home with them. So an American ICE agent is going to be unmasked by the minority leader of the House. Really?
Well, look, I mean, I think there's a growing view inside the party that Hakeem Jeffries is a weak leader. I mean, the reputation, the approval rating of the Democratic Party, you know, according to the NBC poll we talked about a couple times ago, is 27%. The party is widely perceived as being weak, as being out of touch, way too far left. And sort of both Schumer and Jeffries don't have the spine to be able to move the party back to a viable position. What he's saying, I mean, it's just extraordinary that I hear a Democratic leader who said nothing about militant terrorist supporting campus protesters that were attacking Jews and covering their identities with masks, said absolutely nothing about that. That violence has now escalated into open season on Jews and the killing of the two embassy workers in DC and the setting on fire of elderly Jewish folk in Boulder, Colorado. And the Democratic Party's basically been silent on so much of that and given a pass to the left wing on so much of that. And then you have credible reports, at least what I think are credible reports, that the ICE agents are being doxxed by members of the left and they have legitimate safety concerns. And that is the purpose for the masking. And Jeffries comes out and and grandstands on that issue and refers to them as, you know, Soviet or Gestapo. I mean, this is sort of more of the same of the Democratic Party pandering to an extremist fringe of American voters, maybe 10%, and forsaking just basic common sense and decency. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Jeffries were gone in the next session. I don't think anybody thinks he's a particularly strong leader. He's not a particularly persuasive or compelling speaker. I think same for Schumer. And the party is in a mess right now, and it keeps, you know, flailing about. And this is just another example of it.
Well, a couple of things. They're not going to get rid of him because he's a black man, and they're going to be politically correct, and they don't want to get rid of a black leader. Number two is, Julian, I think you have to go the like KJP. I think it's time for you to be an independent, Julian, because until people start stepping up, being more emblematic of a Democratic Party of Bill Clinton and maybe Mike Bloomberg, you know, I don't see why you're staying with these people.
Yeah. It's a good question. I don't sort of agree with anything, almost anything the party is doing today on the issues. I don't agree with any of the tactics. I think the street theater is cringe. I think the oppositional obsession, you know, oppose everything Trump when there's so much to be working with him on both immigration, on sort of the unfair trade, what's going on in Ukraine, Israel, you know, on down the line. There's plenty of common ground if the Democrats would just find it. But they don't want to because, again, they are captured by a small progressive elite that is more interested in being an online influencer than in actually governing in a meaningful way.
Julian Epstein, thanks. Yeah, I hear you. We're up against a break, but that was my opportunity to see if you would go up the middle.
Let's keep Joe Manchin. Let's keep talking about it.
All right. Yeah, Joe Manchin, I think, is the template. Julian Epstein, thanks so much. 1-866. He did go independent at the end. 1-866-408-7669. David Mamet at the bottom of the hour. Your call's next. First Stop St. Louis.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You know, it's like I had a dream and I opened up the first page of her book about the broken White House. And the first sentence says, Peter Ducey told me and I didn't listen to him.
That is true. That is a dream.
It is true.
But she should dedicate the book to you.
And I know we're going to talk about this next hour. But the thing about this book is that she, towards the end, after Biden dropped out, she would say that legitimate questions were misinformation. And I told her once, you can't just call something that you don't like misinformation. And so I don't know how she is going to square being the public face of saying things that we now know were not true about the president and about policies. I don't know how she's now going to come out and say, you know what, just because I swore on camera that things were okay. Actually, here's what was really going on.
That is so funny. Peter Ducey today, just on the intrigue and the maddening way in which all these people are coming clean after 4 years of denying and insulting him when he asks these questions. Linda in St. Louis. Hey, Linda.
Brian, I just want to tell you, I love your show. I think you're the most, and I'm not trying to suck up, I'm just going to say you're the most interesting, knowledgeable, entertaining, humorous, you keep everything light host on the TV and the radio. And I think the way Ainsley treated you this morning on Fox and Friends was way out of line. You are definitely in the right. I think she's getting a little bit too controlling since she got engaged to Sean. But anyway, I love her too.
No, she's all having fun, but go ahead. Thank you for those comments.
And I'm also concerned about Trump alienating Elon. I get the 4 points that Elon brought up, why he's upset, why he called this an abomination, the new beautiful bill. But wow, I mean, was Trump maybe a little bit too hard on these changes that he did, especially taking away Elon's best friend or something that was supposed to be the NASA new administrator? I mean, is that a good idea to alienate Elon?
No, it isn't. But that's why Trump has not fired back at him. Behind the scenes, he's furious, but he has not fired back. And if you ask me, from what I see, the NASA guy seems to be a good guy, but he's a big Democrat supporter. So that's why some Republicans say, we don't want to take a risk. But he's a NASA guy. What is Republican or Democrat about space travel? So that bothered me. And that's one thing would be easy to give him. Now, he also wanted Howard Lutnick as Treasury Secretary. We know that would have been a disaster. They didn't like Scott Bessent had a different idea who should run the IRS, so he swapped out Elon's guy there. I guess he wanted another 130 days. He didn't get it. I don't know why. I would have given it to him and just had him focus on some other things, especially AI, helping out with David Sachs. But he just definitely went off.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think we're doing the funniest version of Glengarry Glen Ross you'll ever
see. Go.
Not because we're twisting the words or changing anything. Yeah. It's just we have comedy backgrounds, most of us. So we're just looking for those moments, and we're playing that timing. I'm playing trying to play a spirited version of Shelley, somebody who really, really believes he's about to make his big score.
Yeah.
Absolutely has no second thoughts about that.
And that is Bob Odenkirk talking about the play that's playing right around the block from us. Glengarry Glen Ross, David Mamet, the award-winning playwright and author of the new book, The Disenlightenment, Politics, Horror, and Entertainment. David, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be here.
So do you still go every night to the play?
Oh God, no! I don't live in the United States. I live in California, and so I'm on the other side of the country.
Okay, but did you get it up and running?
No! It was directed by Patrick Marber in a terrific production. And after I've done a play once, if I'm not directing a revival, I'll just stay away. There's nothing for me to do. I got better things to do with my life, and they got better things to do with their life than to listen to me say that's not the way that we did it when the dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Oh, so in other words, a while ago, and you talked about that when the movie came out, you made the role for Alec Baldwin. Here he is talking about it. Cut 43.
Only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line, which is dotted. A, B, C. A always, B, B, C closing. Always be closing. Always be closing. AIDA, attention, interest, decision, action. Attention, do I have your attention? Interest, are you interested? I know you are. You close or you hit the bricks. Decision, have you made your decision for Christ?
That is, he was great in that, right? Why was he perfect for it?
Yeah.
What made him perfect for it, David?
Well, I wrote the part for him. I did, they were doing this movie. Jamie Foley just died, rest in peace, directed a spectacular production of the movie, Glengarry Glen Ross, of the play. And Alec was going to play a part, but he was restricted because a studio had him on hold for a project which didn't come through. So someone else played the part, and Alec called me up when the studio let him go. We were about to shoot, and he said, I want to be in the movie. What can we do? I said, the part's gone. He said, write me another part. So I did.
And it was worth it. Also, he's from Massapequa, too, and his dad was a teacher at my Massapequa High School, so I know the whole family. So didn't get to know him, though. He's a little bit older. So David, let's talk about what your passion for politics comes from. When did it really take root in your life?
Well, I got kicked out of the left about 25 years ago, and I had to stand back and say, wait a second, I'm a lifelong Democrat. My parents were first-generation immigrant Jews. Everybody was a Democrat. We didn't know any Republicans because, as far as we knew, they all lived in the country clubs from which we were restricted, and they all wore white belts and drank Manhattans. So I didn't know any Republicans. So I didn't understand what conservatism was. And then I got kicked out of the left, and I started researching what the constitutional conservatism was about. And I got very, very interested and very excited about it. And here I am now.
How did you get kicked out of the left?
I was doing a play on Broadway, Paul, a very funny play called November, about a president of the United States who's about to lose an election. because he doesn't have any money, because, as they say, his numbers are lower than Gandhi's cholesterol. And the Village Voice said, well, write an article promoting the play. It was called November. And so I wrote an article called Political Civility. I said, we have to be civil to each other. That's what this play is finally about. It makes fun not of a politician, but of politics. But we have to be civil to each other. I said, I'm not even civil to myself. I even refer to myself as a brain-dead liberal. That's not civil. Next week, the Village Voice comes out, the whole front page, Why I Am No Longer a Brain-Dead Liberal by David Mamet, and everybody lost my number. So I have, like Trump, you know, after the 20 election, I had a little bit of time to think about things.
And that made you dig in more rather than change. Now, instead of taking a back step, you step forward and just reinforced your conservative beliefs?
Well, I discovered my conservative beliefs because I discovered everything I thought I believed about the Democratic Party was false, that the Democratic Party had always been the party of, first off, slavery, and then of segregation, then of Jim Crow, and that affirmative action was just an extension of that. And the Democratic Party was not representing the working people of this country, wasn't representing the actual Americans. It had become a party of the elites. And I started to go back and reread Hayek, and I was very close friends with Shelby Steele, was friends with Tom Sowell, and went back to the original, right? I went back to J.S. Mill and Locke and tried to understand what a constitutional democracy is. And I liked it. I liked it a whole lot, because the whole idea was, let's all get together and decide according to the rules, mm-hmm. which we have enshrined when we were not emotional. Let's decide according to those rules what we're going to do now that we are emotional.
Just take a step back. Before I really can build on that, I want to just take one step back that I've not got a good answer for. If you are successful in your business as a playwright, as an actor, as an actress, it's all meritocracy. I don't care who you know, you might get a part. But if you're not good, if you can't produce under pressure, you're not going to do well. Why wouldn't that mindset transfer into the love of capitalism and appreciation for hard work? Why wouldn't there be more David Mamets in that world and less socialists?
Well, that's a very good question. What I saw when I was beginning to understand conservatism was the theater was a complete, at that point, a complete meritocracy, that if you could get the asses in the seats, you could pay the rent on your apartment, and if you could get enough asses on the seats, you could buy a house, and that the audience at that time didn't care what your politics were. But the problem was, as things became very corporatized in the media, they became homogenized, and actors started just like anyone else. Look at Karine Jean-Pierre and Tapper all of a sudden came out and they wanted to make more money off of the horrors which they'd inflicted on us personally by saying, gosh, we didn't know. I get it. So that actors who were concerned and writers who were concerned about their place wanted to hedge their bets by saying, you know, I'm a liberal too. And it started with in the 60s doing plays about diseases, right? Cancer is bad, fighting cancer is good, blah, 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 blindness is bad, fighting blindness is good. Okay, then it became plays about social consciousness. Black people are people too, gay people are people too. But the problem with that is everybody knows that. So that we don't want to come to a theater or a movie to get lectured to, right? Our wives will do that. So that in order to keep their place, the idea of a meritocracy crumbled in the media. So that awards and safety, or the illusion of same, was awarded to those who could scream loudest, I'm good, and I'll tell you who's bad so you can hate them and get a kick out of that.
Got it. So the disenlightenment, politics, horror, and entertainment. When did we start moving? When did we stop being trying on a path to enlightenment? Why did it become disenlightenment?
Well, there's two reasons. Everything in life is organic. It's organic means it's born It lives, it decays, and it dies. And there are two reasons why any organism decays and dies. One is it's unsuccessful, and the other is that it is successful. So just as with a tree, if you don't prune the tree wants to put out more branches, wants to put out more branches to get more light. But if you don't prune the branches once in a while, the branch structure overwhelms the root structure, and the tree gets blown down. So as our country became more and more and more successful, we got people in power who wanted to double down on building their power. Why not? Right? They're human beings. The problem is that, for example, in California, if the taxes go up, which means that the revenue goes down, as the revenue goes down, the people in the Democratic state know only one way to increase revenue, which is to increase taxes. Okay? So the people that you're taxing away don't add to what you're doing. They don't add to the revenue stream, so you keep increasing taxes, and the state dies. So that's what we've seen in California, and in fact in all of the blue states, that they don't have the capacity to cut, to prune. They don't have the capacity to say, "I get it."
Yep.
But we're going to restrain ourselves.
But David, don't you feel optimistic that as you see the decay in the cities like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles and the lack of being able to rebuild in Pacific Palisades, that people are beginning to realize the model doesn't work? All we get is more homelessness, higher taxes. People are voting with their feet. Do you feel as though America is self-correcting again?
Well, America is self-correcting again, as we saw in the election. Nationally, it's self-correcting again, and the red states are thriving. The question is what's going to happen to the other states. And the answer is, I don't know. I mean, my hope for this wonderful state of California, this is the most beautiful spot in the world, is that the Hispanic population, which a super hardworking population and a growing population and a religious population, is going to take the Spanish land grants back, and you know, and vote us into conservatism again.
Yeah, it would be great. I saw, like, I've been watching you do your press tour. I saw you out with Bill Maher the other day. I just want to let the audience hear a little of your exchange. Let's watch.
I don't have to imagine what he did in 2020, which was never concede the election. I'm not even.
Dude, he didn't have to concede the election. He lost. If somebody is beaten in a prize fight and the other guy gets the belt, the person who's beaten does not have to concede. It's not necessary. He's lost.
Well, it is necessary. The analogy falls down because if a prize fighter loses, it doesn't inspire people to riot.
How did he inspire people to riot?
By not conceding the election.
Oh, come on. Yeah, cute, huh?
I liked it. And he went back. One thing, he can have real conversations. You could disagree with him on his own show. It's great. And you went on to say, yeah, he did not inspire people to riot. And you also went on to say, too, is that Trump called you after your interview with Bill Maher and he said, hey, go the rest of the way and defend me on 2020, right?
That's exactly right. But see, Bill, who's I like him very much. We get along very, very well. But he's in a very difficult position because his rice bowl is playing to a liberal audience. I get it. And on the other hand, he's capable of thinking clearly from time to time. But what he did to me is a perfect example of magical thinking, because he said that people, quote, rioted at January 6th because Trump did not say these two words, "I concede." Had Trump said those words, that would have had the power to alter history. So this is magical thinking, exactly on the level of saying that Jews poison wells.
I hear you. And by the way, just to keep people up to date, the president did announce about an hour ago he had a 90-minute conversation with President Xi, at which time they agreed to visit each other's countries and a positive and move forward on trade. That's all they talked about. And now the president's meeting with the chancellor of Germany, and it's always intriguing to see them in the Oval Office. Final thought, David, as we look at this book, Disenlightenment, Politics, Horror, and Entertainment, you're listening. My audience is very into these subjects, and you go deep into it. What will we discover in your book in reading it?
Well, here's what I think. I think there are a bunch of essays on various topics, but what I did in the book is at the end, I tried to draw it all together and say, what are we seeing? How are open borders related to queers for Palestine? How are they related to global warming? How are they related to covering up COVID? And what I came up with was there's nobody home. It's not that we have an evil administration during the Biden administration. We had no administration. So the underlings, the cat being away, the underlings played and they sat around the table saying, okay, you can have open borders if I get to pull out of Afghanistan. Susie, what do you want? Oh, I want queers for Palestine. Okay, you can have that if Bob gets to put drag shows in the high school. So this, what we're looking at is what was called an open city. For example, Paris in 1944, the Nazis got out of town, the Allies had not yet come in, so you had a bunch of little groups, each with its own depredation and each with its own territory, fighting each other. And in the midst of that, because there was no law, you had people settling scores, saying, well, I'm not a communist, I'm not a capitalist, I'm not a resistant, but I got a big grocery bill, I'm going to shoot the grocer. So that's what we saw, and that's what I'm saying in the book. That's the totality of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, David, I'm just encouraged by, I feel like we're really woken up to a lot of these issues and we're fixing them in real time. And President Trump is doing it. And I think the majority of the American people who aren't even political understand there's a logic and a common sense to it that I think is back. So pick up David Mamet's book, Disenlightenment, Politics, Horror, and Entertainment. Thanks, David, for your time.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's good talking to you, Brian.
Same here. Back in a moment.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Mr. President.
What do you expect from Germany and what do you expect from the Chancellor?
Well, first of all, I'm glad to meet because I've been dealing with the Chancellor and he's a very good man to deal with. He's difficult, I would say. Can I say that? It's a positive.
Go ahead.
You wouldn't want me to say you're easy, right?
No.
Yeah, he's a very great representative of Germany. I think all we want is just going to have a good relationship. The rest will just sort of follow very easily. We'll have a good trade deal. I mean, I guess that will be mostly determined by the European Union, but very big part of that.
Yep. So that is the German Chancellor, just elected, and he's more conservative. He is definitely stronger on the border and on immigration. He's definitely going to build up defense. I don't know if it's going to get to 5%. President playfully saying, I don't know. General MacArthur said, don't rearm Germany, whatever you do, after World War I or World War II. But he thinks it's a different time now. I know it is. I also want to see Japan rearmed. It makes us life easier with China and Southeast Asia. And we know the president's making a lot of news right now. The market's responding positively to the point where he said he had just talked solid trade with President Xi, at which time they got clear on the rare earth that he's holding back that we buy, that we need for technology. I don't know why we haven't figured out other venues, technology as well for as our military. And they invited each other to each other's country. So the market likes that. The market likes the fact the chancellor's meeting with the president. You know what would be great? Right after the president has a press conference to announce a deal with the EU, Japan, India, because, you know, we were promised by Peter Navarro. He's the brainchild of this tariffs. 90 deals in 90 days. We got one. Need some more. President's pretty confident, though. He's on a fast course, 11 weeks in, and he thinks things are going in the right direction, and I do, too. Don't forget, go to BrianKilmeade.com. Thanks to Fox Nation, you'll be able to see us on the 21st in Dayton, Ohio, Victoria Theater.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.